Welcome to the program, where Palestinian civilians fall victim to Israel's genocidal war on Gaza as the regime continues to pound the blockaded territory with air and artillery strikes. The regime's latest airstrike killed 7 civilians, including 5 children, east of Jabalia in northern Gaza. Earlier, at least 2 Palestinian civilians were killed and 2 others injured after Israeli warplanes bombed a vehicle in the Al-Zahur neighborhood near the southern city of Rafah. Also in Rafah, a Palestinian child succumbed to wounds she sustained after being shot by Israeli forces. Several Palestinians were also killed in repeated Israeli attacks on the Al-Mawazi area near the southern city of Khan Yunis. In central Gaza, an Israeli airstrike killed former Palestinian prisoner Jabr Amar in the Al-Buraiji refugee camp. According to Health Ministry, over 60 Palestinians were killed and nearly 360 injured in Tuesday's airstrikes. The new fatalities brings the death toll from Israel's renewed aggression on Gaza since March the 18th to nearly 800. The overall death toll from the regime's genocide since October 2023 now stands at over 50,140, with more than 113,700 others injured. We earlier talked to our Gaza correspondent Moti Abu Musabeh to bring us up to speed on Israel's latest violations of the ceasefire agreement. Let's take a listen.
The Israeli occupation forces intensified the artillery shelling against vast areas of Be'er Lahia, in addition to multiple areas of the northern part of Gaza Strip. And here in the central area of Gaza Strip, the eastern parts of this section of the Gaza Strip actually is still witnessing more cruel attacks of the Israeli occupation forces, particularly when it comes to the heavy gunfire maintained by the Israeli tanks mobilized in the eastern section of Deir al-Balah city. In particular, hundreds of the Palestinian families are still beleaguered and besieged in Tal al-Sultan neighborhood, in addition to the Saudi village and the western part of Rafah city. They are exposed and subjected to more cruel attacks by the Israeli occupation forces. They do not have any access to the basic humanitarian essentials and the life-saving materials. For more than 221 consecutive days, Palestinian people are still they do not have any access to those basic humanitarian necessities. And regarding the latest statements of the Gaza civil defense system here, at least 15 members of the civil defense teams, in addition to the paramedics, are still unreachable. Their fate is still unknown for more than 7 consecutive days after they were, as you know, they were dispatched in order to rescue multiple Palestinian families in Rafah City with the very beginning of this genocidal operation targeting the western parts of Rafah City. Until this moment, no one knows anything about them. Apparently, they were targeted by the Israeli occupation forces.
Gaza's health ministry warns that Israel is enforcing a policy of slowly killing Palestinians by blocking the entry of aid, including fuel and medical supplies, into the territory. The ministry added that Gaza is facing severe shortages of fuel and essential medical supplies, including gauze and oxygen tanks. It noted that there is only one operational power generator at the Indonesian hospital, where 7 intensive care patients are at risk if the generator fails. The ministry stressed that the lack of medicine for chronic illnesses, such as hypertension and diabetes, is leading to more deaths in Gaza. It described Israel's war on Gaza as a war of annihilation, adding that the current state of the territory's health sector is beyond catastrophic. Israel is well known for its systematic killing of journalists in order to silence voices exposing atrocities against the Palestinians. The regime has added another page on its dark history by assassinating Hussam Shabat, a prominent journalist and activist in Gaza. His death sent a shockwave across the Palestinian community. Father Ibrahim has the details.
The Israeli regime has long record of intentionally targeting journalists, a tactic used to silence those exposing its war crimes and human rights violations. In the past 17 months, 208 journalists have been killed by Israeli occupation forces, Assassination of journalist Hossam Shabat is the latest crime.
Hossam was wearing his press hamlet and vest committing to the safety and journalism standards. However, he was hit by an Israeli missile. Hossam was documenting the Israeli bombing and crimes against his people. That's why he got killed. Surely, as journalists, we appeal to the international community to stop the killing of the journalists.
Known for his relentless efforts to expose Israeli war crimes, genocide, and human rights abuses perpetrated against the Palestinian people, Shabat's killing underscores a disturbing pattern of violence directed towards the press by the Israeli forces to mute any voice calling for justice.
The Israeli occupation deliberately targets the journalists in Gaza since the beginning of the war. Hossam and Mohamed Mansi were killed on the same day, mounting the journalist's death toll to 208. That is an additional proof that the Israeli regime does deliberately and systematically kill the journalists. Prior to his assassination, Hossam was threatened by the Israeli army.
I documented the horrors in northern Gaza minute by minute, determined to show the world the truth they tried to bury. I slept on pavements, in schools, in tents, anywhere I could. Each day was a battle for survival. I endured hunger for months, yet I never left my people's side. That were his last words on X. Shabat's assassination is a stark reminder that the Israeli regime continues to be engaged in a genocidal campaign against the Palestinians, one that seeks not only to annihilate their bodies, but also to erase their voices. Ghad Ibrahim, Gaza City.
Israeli forces continue to kill more civilians during violent raids on Palestinian towns and villages across the occupied West Bank. In one of their latest incursions, the regime's forces fatally shot a Palestinian man near the town of Al-Azariya, east of the city of Al-Quds. According to Palestinian sources, Mohammad Hassan Hosni Abu Hamad was critically injured by Israeli forces' live fire and was later pronounced dead at hospital. The regime's forces also killed a Palestinian youth in another raid east of the city of Jenin. Earlier the same day, a young Palestinian was killed after Israeli forces opened fire on a commercial store in the city of Qalqidiya. The new fatalities bring to nearly 940 the total number of Palestinians killed by Israeli forces across the occupied West Bank since October 2023, when the regime started its genocide on the Gaza Strip. Israel has intensified its settlement expansion in the occupied West Bank. Far-right Minister Bezalel Smotrich has pushed forward a plan to separate 13 settler neighborhoods from their parent settlements, granting them independent status. Critics say the move accelerates land confiscation and further entrenches Israeli control. Our correspondent Naga Hamid has more from Ramallah.
The Israeli regime has once again given its green light to a plan that strengthens its grip on the occupied West Bank. The latest move, orchestrated by far-right Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich, grants independent status to 13 settler neighborhoods, making them eligible for direct infrastructure and financial support. Analysts warn that this will accelerate land confiscation, allowing the regime to deepen its settlement enterprise at the expense of Palestinian communities.
Annexation is a process, and that's what's happening, like not now. One of the main junctions for that is in 2020, when that time Trump was in power and when they announced the annexation plan officially. It is the first time that they announced a map and they announced about the annexation plan. From there, they started the demolition of the Palestinian communities, taking more and more lands. And also, when this fascist government came to the power, they accelerated this.
For 3 years, the Israeli regime has allocated huge resources to push towards more land grip in Area C. Almost $3 billion were apportioned to make the lives of the settlers easier in the West Bank's stolen lands.
All the settlements had been established in the Area C in the West Bank. Area C, 62% of the West Bank, which all the Palestinian resources there, water resources, agricultural land, everything for the Palestinians. What's been left for the Palestinians out of Area C is Area A and B, which is the built-up area. There's nothing to live on. What they are trying to do is just to make out of the West Bank another two or three even more Gaza strips in the West Bank, separated cantons that are isolated from each other without any resources, depending totally on Israel and under mercy of their military and settlers.
The de facto situation which the regime is imposing every day in the West Bank aims, according to analysts, to expel Palestinians forcibly or willfully.
Israel is expanding settlement outposts, granting them local councils and huge budgets. The upcoming budget includes massive funds for settlement growth, first legalizing outposts, then developing them into full-scale cities. Meanwhile, settler violence targets Palestinian towns, isolating communities and confining them to segregated areas. The goal is clear: make life unbearable for Palestinians, forcing them toward displacement.
Israel has been expanding settlement despite global condemnations. The new separation plan effectively legalizes further land grabs, making it easier to build and connect settlements while cutting off Palestinian areas. Israel's settlement expansion continues to reshape the West Bank's landscape, making a future Palestine state increasingly unviable. As Palestinian communities face ongoing land seizures, the world remains largely silent. Naqa Ahmed, Ramallah, Occupied West Bank.
In Turkey, demonstrations against the detention of former Istanbul Mayor Ekrem İmamoğlu continue unabated as thousands return to the city's streets. Thousands of university students flooded a major district in Istanbul, heading for the municipal headquarters. They demanded resignation of the government while waving flags and banners. People in nearby buildings bashed pots to show their solidarity with protesters. The new demonstration came after a court in Istanbul jailed seven journalists for covering the protests. Separately, thousands also rallied for the eighth straight night in a protest organized by İmamoğlu's Republican People's Party, or the CHP. The leader of the opposition party has called for mass rallies over the weekend to protest the arrest of İmamoğlu, demand open trials, and call for early elections. The call for the Saturday rally comes as almost 1,500 people have been arrested already. İmamoğlu, a politician from the CHP, was seen as the main rival to the incumbent Turkish president Recep Tayyip Erdogan for the next presidential election, slated for 2028. Academic and political analyst Bruno Biclini believes that the imprisonment of Istanbul's mayor poses a significant political risk to the Turkish president Recep Tayyip Erdogan.
İmamoğlu, the Istanbul mayor, he represents the CHP, he represents the civil elite of family who has been in alliance, political alliance with the HDP. It is the umbrella of the, I would say, the left side of the Kurdish people inside of Turkey. And they are trying to build a bridge between center-left, social democrats, and social liberals. Average Turkish people, they do not anymore believe on the legal system. They understand that the legal system may be manipulated as far as Erdogan and their allies want to change it. CHP, together with the ultra-right-wing nationalists, the MHP, which are the allies of the AK party of Erdogan, those two parties, they are the founders of modern Turkey. So the Erdogan's cabinet is putting in jail new leadership from the biggest party of the country from the last 100 years. It's a risk for those who are not in favor of Erdogan or those who are not in favor of the alliance between AK party, Erdogan's party, and the MHP party, because the MHP party represents a rival the ultra-right wings will be coming from the junta, military juntas, who has been done for coup d'etat against Turkish democracy on all over the 20th century.
Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has unveiled another underground facility housing hundreds of domestically built precision strike missiles. According to the IRGC, the new underground facility is among hundreds of missile cities built across the Iranian territory by its aerospace division. The facility houses various types of precision strike ballistic and cruise missiles, including Khaybar Shekan, Emad Sijil, and Qadr. Chief of Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces Major General Mohammad Bagheri paid a visit to the facility along with the commander of the IRGC's Aerospace Division, Brigadier General Amir Ali Hajizadeh. He described the facility as an evidence to the armed forces' determination to continue to grow, advance, and enhance their capabilities. The new facility was unveiled less than a week after the IRGC revealed three underground hangars on three Iranian islands of Greater Tomb, Lesser Tomb, and Abu Musa in the Persian Gulf. They also house advanced cruise missiles capable of striking naval targets at a distance of up to 600 kilometers from their base. Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi reiterates that Iran won't take part in direct negotiations with the U.S. under Washington's maximum pressure, military threats, and increasing economic sanctions. Araghchi, however, said Iran has always been ready for talks about its peaceful nuclear program for more clarification. In this regard, according to Araghchi, the country is carrying out consultations with three European countries. The top Iranian diplomat noted that Iran has never left the negotiating table over its peaceful nuclear activities. Araghchi made the remarks in a presser with his Armenian counterpart Ararat Mirzoyan. Regarding regional issues, Araghchi said, Iran welcomes a peace deal between Armenia and Azerbaijan, expressing hope that obstacles to achieve the agreement will be removed soon. And that's it for this bulletin. Bye for now.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
The Zionist regime has failed to achieve its stated objectives of crushing the resistance groups, which still maintain the upper hand in their demands and negotiations in both Gaza and Lebanon. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Press TV wrote, despite Israel's repeated aggressions and escalating violations, normalization remains responsible, while the people's resistance and resolve persist. On March 23rd, the Zionist regime re-enacted the Majdal Sham scenario, claiming that an influx of rocket fire from Lebanon was launched by Hezbollah, a claim that the resistance movement flatly denied. That day, the Tel Aviv regime again unleashed its wrath, killing several people in Tulin and Tyre, South Lebanon, in attacks described unprecedented since November 2024 ceasefire between the two sides. As regional tensions reach a boiling point, with the United States reaffirming its resolve to act against resistance forces across the region, aggression against Yemen has escalated and the genocidal war on Gaza has resumed. Yemen has severed the U.S. and Zionist entity's sea supply routes, Lebanon remains key to Tel Aviv's hostility due to its geographic proximity. Resistance capability to strike deep inside the occupied territories has grown, and the threat of the elite Radwan division storming in from the north to liberate Palestine remains in place. For these reasons, among others, Lebanon and the elimination of its resistance movement has always been existential priorities for both the U.S. and its proxy Zionist entity. On February 18th, the Zionist entity refused to withdraw from five key points: Al-Labune near the Naqoura outskirts, near Jal Adair in Aitarun, near Hammam's Hill opposite Metula, visible from Kafar Kila but south of Khiyam, Jabal Blat in Marwahin and Remyeh, and the outskirts between Markaba and Hula. After the so-called ceasefire deadline, an extension unilaterally demanded by the Zionist entity, these 5 points were not only declared sites of indefinite occupation, as the Israeli war minister Israel Katz arrogantly stated days ago, but also became strategic locations for controlling the roads that connect them. The objective behind this prolonged occupation is unmistakable: laying the groundwork for a new so-called security belt to serve as a launchpad for further illegal expansion into Lebanon, a futile attempt to revert the equation to the days of the 1978 occupation of the country's south. Entire roads have been closed off, including the route from Odessa to Kafar Kila and Markaba Hula roads linking the eastern and western sectors, and the roads leading to Jabal Blat and Naqoura. The apartheid regime is not merely occupying 5 isolated points, but is working to seize an entire stretch of Lebanese territory, carving out a new buffer zone that serves as a launchpad for expanded invasion. While the United States has tempered Israeli demands for yet another extension of the so-called ceasefire, it has simultaneously provided the logistical, political, and material support for continued Zionist occupation and coercion. Exploiting Beirut's urgent need for economic reconstruction and recovery, the U.S. has tied financial relief to normalization with Israel, using it as a precondition. This aligns with the vision articulated by U.S. Special Envoy Stephen Witkoff, who spoke of the potential for Syria and Lebanon to enter into normalization agreements with the Tel Aviv regime led by Benjamin Netanyahu. It also reflects the long-standing strategy evident in World Bank and IMF policies, particularly in the aftermath of the 2019 economic crisis, of linking Lebanon's economic recovery to both normalization with the Zionist regime and the disarmament of the resistance. Meanwhile, routine assassinations targeting civilian vehicles, often killing off-duty Hezbollah movement members going about their daily lives outside the context of battle, have become more frequent. Nearly every day since the U.S. delegation's last visit to Lebanon, deadly drone attacks on vehicles have terrorized local populations. This relentless and carefully campaign is yet another demonstration of Israel's unchecked impunity exercised without restraint in Lebanon. The appointment of former Lebanese Army Commander Joseph Aoun to the presidency after years of serving the U.S. ambassador is just one of many steps Washington has taken to tighten its grip on Lebanon, aggressively working to isolate and dismantle the Hezbollah resistance group. Through economic and political coercion, the Lebanese army has been stripped of its role as the protector of the state and its people, an ongoing trend that reached new lows during and after the latest war on Lebanon. The army was instructed not to assist displaced civilians or repair border crossings destroyed by Israel, effectively reducing it to a weakened auxiliary force enforcing American hegemonic mandates in the region. Now, with a thoroughly compliant president and prime minister in place, Prime Minister Nawaf Salam, who has openly dismissed the slogan People Army Resistance as a thing of the past and declared that investments will not come to Lebanon as long as there are weapons outside the authority of the state, Washington's influence over the Lebanese administration is clearer than ever.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, other effects of eating less. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z with me, Sister Zainab on Ivy English Radio. And obviously, today has a very obvious title, Other Effects of Eating Less. And this is during the holy month of Ramadan. And so these in a sense, are also effects. They're very obvious, but maybe we don't even think about them so much. But they actually have also, in a sense, deeper meanings and sort of very great benefits that go very deep indeed. So you can imagine and just think to yourself, I don't know how it is with your families or friends. Now, obviously, if this applies both to suhoor, applies for iftar, and for sure also applies to the special meals, maybe at Eid. But let's just talk first just about the day-to-day meals, in a sense, but nothing in Ramadan is really day-to-day because it is special, the suhoor and the iftar meal. So obviously, if we're spending, let's say, a lot of time preparing quite lavish meals or big spreads, whether it's for suhoor, then especially for iftar. So I don't know, maybe you've observed, for example, people in your family, maybe you see your mother literally slaving away the whole afternoon during the last hours of fasting, preparing some huge meal for iftar. And, you know, maybe some other people in the family are not engaged in that, and maybe they're spending extra time reading the Quran or making dua, and just think for yourself, well, I mean, that's not really fair, is it? That, you know, obviously, because, and this was the one point I was going to make, if we're spending huge amounts of time during the month of Ramadan preparing food, and that maybe is preparing the food, setting table, and then clearing away and washing everything, in a sense, we're also taking time away from worship. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IB English Radio. So I'm talking about some of the very obvious effects of eating less during the holy month of Ramadan, but that maybe aren't focused on so much. For example, the idea of just spending a lot of time preparing food, that obviously, in a sense, we might be cutting away time from our worship. We might be cutting away time from just, you know, having deeper, meaningful conversations with family members, with friends. We might be cutting away time from just that quiet time, that silence, really just remembering Allah in silence rather than being busy in the kitchen for hours to prepare all this food. Now, and then there's another point, of course, in a sense. So fasting has this other sort of good thing. I don't know if this applies. It goes with the other point I've just mentioned, because obviously if people are preparing huge meals every day, both for suhoor and iftar, maybe this doesn't apply. But imagine yourself, in theory, if we're eating less, that also means we should be spending less money on food during the holy month of Ramadan, in theory. So that means, in theory, we should be able to give more money for charity, to the poor, to whoever is in need, even to family members who maybe are facing hard times. So that's another point. So obviously I always admit, well, maybe this is maybe these are several reasons for avoiding these really big lavish iftar feasts. And, you know, I've attended maybe iftar. I've attended different types of iftar. I've attended iftar that were very simple, you know, one meal, just one dish. And, you know, obviously, whatever people have some milk, people have some hot water or sort of tea, whatever it is, just the water to break their fast and just a couple of dates. So, and I've seen the frugality, and I've seen the total opposite. And yeah, but maybe these two main points I mentioned give you just some ideas on some of the other benefits we have during the month of Ramadan. So I look forward to welcoming you to another episode of A to Z here on Arab English Radio, and farewell for today. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment. In the limelight.
The challenges posed by U.S. tariffs and strategic defense shifts represent a defining moment for the European Union. Experts say economic diversification, bolstered defense capabilities, and stronger partnerships with emerging powers are key to reducing dependence on the United States of America. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Press TV wrote, during his first term in office, U.S. President Donald Trump unsuccessfully attempt to use a trade war to break the European Union, which he has described as a union of 27 free riders established to screw the United States. European leaders managed to weather the storm not through sound policy decisions, but by simply waiting out the Trump presidency, which was itself faltering under the weight of the COVID pandemic and other internal crises. The EU escaped relatively unscathed, and the Union remained largely united. However, Trump's second-term strategy appears to have found a more vulnerable target, the EU's unity in the face of a massive security crisis. By withdrawing support for Ukraine, Trump has engineered a situation that exposes deep cracks within the 27-nation bloc. As a cunning dealmaker with a keen eye for profit, he is poised to exploit those fissures. For Trump,
The EU is just another supranational entity, like the World Trade Organization and the World Health Organization, that he believes keeping exploiting America. A strong EU presents a major obstacle to his vision of a great America, which must be able to dominate the rest of the world. Since taking office for the second term in January, his actions suggest a calculated effort to weaken EU institutions and the NATO military alliance founded in 1949 on the principle of so-called collective defense. Trump argues that the United States has been footing the bill for this security umbrella under which Europeans have rebuilt their economies from the ashes of the Second World War without having to worry about or spend disproportionately on defense matters. That sense of security through collective defense has been significantly undermined by Trump's decision to withdraw U.S. military and intelligence support for Ukraine on terms that would benefit Moscow. This has left the EU scrambling to fill the void. However, it is during tough times like these that cracks begin to surface in alliances. While some member states advocate for stronger collective action, others hesitate, wary of the economic and political cost. A fragmented EU is exactly what Trump desires. Trump's gambit could prove costly for the United States as well. The stakes are high, but so is the potential payoff. A divided EU not only advances his immediate goals, but also bolsters his narrative of America as a lone powerhouse unshackled by multilateral commitments. Trump has also reintroduced his trade war into the mix. This month, he announced 25% tariffs on EU steel, aluminum, cars, and agricultural products. In response, the EU retaliated with its own tariffs, targeting major American products such as Harley-Davidson motorcycles and jeans. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said in a statement, "We deeply regret this measure. Tariffs are taxes. They are bad for business and even worse for consumers. These tariffs are disrupting supply chains. They bring uncertainty to the economy. Jobs are at stake. Prices will go up in Europe and the United States. The European Union must act to protect consumers and business." The EU, an integrated single market of 450 million people, wants to send an unmistakable message to Trump that the bloc means business when it comes to defending its economic interests. However, for the EU, the question is no longer simply how to respond to these measures, but how to redefine its role on the world stage as it wakes up to the idea of the United States as an increasingly unreliable partner. The Trump administration's trade war is part of a broader strategy of economic nationalism. The tariffs, justified by the White House as necessary to protect national security, have sent shockwaves through European industries. Europe's initial response, a mix of retaliatory tariffs, was as much a reflection of its frustration as it was calculated economic strategy. However, as the economic impacts begin to ripple through the EU, policymakers are increasingly recognizing the need for a more strategic long-term approach. The revival of trade agreements, such as the 2019 EU-Mercosur Association Agreement, highlights Europe's determination to diversify its economic partnerships. This pact, which connects the EU with Argentina, Brazil, Paraguay, and Uruguay, provides access to an estimated 400 million consumers and offers the bloc a pathway to reduce its reliance on U.S. markets. Additionally, the European Union is increasingly reaching out to emerging markets in Asia. The European Commission President's push for a free trade agreement with India is part of this strategy. While tariffs dominate the headlines, the Trump administration's stance on defense carries equally profound implications for transatlantic relations. NATO has been unsettled by Trump's unpredictable approach to collective defense. His reluctance to reaffirm the U.S. ironclad commitment to Article 5, the alliance's mutual defense clause, has left European allies doubting the reliability of U.S. support. In remarks made in Warsaw last month, U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth warned Europeans that American troops may not remain in Europe indefinitely. He said troop levels depend on the threat level, America's strategic posture, and most importantly, the extent to which European countries are willing and able to step up. He stressed, "That's why our message is so stark to our European allies. Now is the time to invest because you can't assume that America's pressure will last forever." Approximately 100,000 U.S. personnel are currently stationed on the continent, serving as a deterrent against potential adversaries like Russia. A reduction or complete withdrawal of these forces would compel Europe to confront its own military limitations. The possibility of restricted access to U.S.-made weapons and surveillance systems adds another layer of complexity. NATO officials have raised alarms about the operational challenges posed by reduced intelligence sharing and surveillance capabilities. These concerns follow recent reports that the United States is pausing its cyber attacks against Russia, a move many Europeans interpret as a signal of waning American commitment to countering the Kremlin. In response to these developments, the concept of strategy autonomy has gained traction within the EU. Led by France and embraced by other member states, this vision calls for Europe to develop independent capabilities in defense, technology, and economic policy. While the idea has been around for a while, recent events, including Trump's row with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky at the White House, have lent it a sense of newfound urgency. However, European leaders know all too well that the EU's path to strategic autonomy is fraught with obstacles. Data from Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, CIPRI, reveals a stark reality. NATO countries in Europe have more than doubled their arms imports between 2020 and 2024, with the United States of America supplying a substantial 64% of these weapons. This marks a sharp increase compared to the previous five-year period, indicating that Europe has been moving further away from achieving any semblance of a strategic autonomy in defense.
Welcome to the Israel Watch. Hebrew media focused on the Israeli ground incursion into Gaza as the aerial assault on the strip continues with Al-Qassam Brigade's response in which a rocket barrage was launched towards Tel Aviv. Additionally, Yemen's success in launching missiles at Tel Aviv and its surroundings, along with the dismissal of the Shin Bet Sheaf, were key topics discussed in Hebrew media. We will discuss these issues with General Lies Farhat, military and strategic expert. Hello and welcome to this episode, General. The Israeli ground incursion into Gaza may turn into a full-scale war. something Israeli commentators have warned about. One of them pointed out that the Israeli army is suffering from a shortage of soldiers, as noted by Israeli military analyst Roy Sharon. In your opinion, General, how much can Israel actually achieve if they want to launch a ground incursion?
The ground incursion is not a big military
operation.
Operation with respect to Israel, because there is a superiority of Israel compared to Hamas. Hamas is they are working underground and in the tunnels and in the debris. But they don't have, open fortifications or open positions in order to attack or to defend. So it's not an operation that to come to Eretz, from Eretz to Netzirim or to some villages in Gaza. But this has a political.
So could they do a ground operation?
Yes, they could do it easily, but they will put their forces.
But they paid a very heavy price when they did it the first time.
I don't think that they will pay a price during their advance to occupy new positions. But
why?
Because it's so easy to them. There are no armed groups from the resistance to confront them. But as soon as they occupy the positions, they would be subject to attacks from surprise attacks from the resistance.
Okay. On the, because of the traps.
Yes, a surprise attack and different attacks, and it's not a conventional attack or defense. Offensive and defense, it would be.
It's like what happened with the Americans in Iraq?
Yes, it's like the Americans in Iraq, and it would be raids on the Netzirim line, which the Israeli forces expected to deploy.
Okay, meanwhile, some argue that resuming the war on Gaza and canceling the ceasefire agreement is a mistake. They believe Israeli officials still do not understand how Hamas thinks. In your own opinion, can Hamas be eliminated in a longer-term plan?
It's impossible to eliminate Hamas as far as this man said on the TV that they will cut the grass from the upper grass, and what about the deep-rooted grass in the ground, and it will be more rigid and more strong. This is the case in Gaza, actually, because the underground Hamas is much more powerful than the upper grass. Now, the Hamas is the resistance, and the resistance is an idea.
Yes.
An idea, and the idea cannot be eliminated by force.
Is that why the U.S. Middle East envoy Steve Witkoff highlighted that Hamas can remain active after it disarms?
Of course, because
of what you're highlighting,
because
Hamas is an idea. They came to that conclusion, in your own opinion?
Yes, it's not only a military organization or it's a part of a paramilitary force.
Mm-hmm.
It is a political party. It's an idea. It's a belief. It's more than.
And the Israelis have realized that, in your own opinion.
How
do you justify such a statement, Ahmed? War.
Yes, some of them realize, but the warmongers, they do not believe in such political beliefs or such religious trends or something like this. They believe that this is. A group or military group, a company, and a section, a brigade, and we will destroy this brigade. It's not a military operation only. It's a political and military and social operation. You can't uproot Hamas from the people of Gaza. From they are religious. They have their own. Belief in sacred war against the Israeli occupation. It's not easy to eliminate the Hamas as as an idea.
However, on Israeli social media, there was strong engagement with the Israeli military incursion into Gaza, with many calls for a large-scale, all-out war on the Strip. Here are some of them.
Raoud, how do we stop the war? Do we stop the war and wait for Hamas to grow strong again and to do to us what they did on October 7 again? Haim Ezer, we are not threatening. We have long passed that stage. Netanyahu, Yair, Avan Bar, Smotrich, and Ben-Gavir are partners. With them, we can invade Gaza completely. Itamar, send more troops immediately to reinforce the army in Gaza.
So it seems, General, that the Israeli settlers support an escalation in Gaza.
The Israeli settlers are from the extremists, the fanatics that they express the point of view of all the extremism in Gaza and Palestinians towards Gaza. But I think it's worth mentioning that they occupied, for example, Khan Yunus 5 times and for Beit Lahia 4 times.
And they did not achieve their goals.
They didn't achieve two goals. So
yes.
To occupy it another time will not end the situation that they are suffering from. So I don't think that...
But there are voices, Israeli voices, that refuse any escalation in Gaza, especially that the captives did not return to their own families.
Are two different voices. Voices which they think by their minds in order to return back the captives. And there are other the fanatics who they do not join the army. They want the others to occupy Gaza and to wipe out the Palestinians and to wipe out
and
Hamas.
And they only write statements on social media platforms. Shifting to the Yemeni front, which is supporting Gaza with missile strikes on Israel, particularly on Tel Aviv and its surroundings. Hebrew media commentators question the heavy price Netanyahu promised to impose on Yemen, which has yet to materialize. Do you anticipate a more escalation between Israel and the U.S. and Yemen on the other?
Of course, the Yemen intervention as the support to the Gaza resistance was a surprise, first of all, to the Palestinians, to the Israelis, and to the U.S. as well. And the closure of the Bab el-Mandeb siege and the preventing the navigation to Eilat and to other Israeli ports. It was also a surprise, and even the United States and the when they formed the Prosperity Guardian Force, by which it's a fleet from the U.S. and other allies in order to ensure what they called the freedom of navigation in the Northern Indian Ocean and in the Bab el-Mandeb and the Red Sea, they failed to confront and to prevent the Yemenis from closing the strait and the navigation in the Red Sea, as well as the launching Palestine missile missiles, which are hypersonic missiles that can reach the target within 12 minutes from Yemen to...
Yes, and here I wanted to ask, what are the repercussions of Yemeni strikes? Missile striking Israel, taking it back into what we already seen, an atmosphere of fear, running to shelter, war.
Yes, there's an act of fear. There are people are running out to the shelters, but they expect also more and more. What happens when a missile that explodes over a gatherings of people or a building or something like this? They fear from the near future of another weapons which the Yemenis announced that they have another weapons
now. Advanced,
yes,
also.
Yes, they are now warning them in one missile a day, but they are expecting more and more that will spoil all their plans of returning back to the normal
and
situation.
That's why here the commentator highlighted that we want to see if Netanyahu will actually fulfill his promise in halting, of course, the Yemeni act. The Yemeni missile strikes on Tel Aviv military bases and Ben Gurion Airport continue, despite intense American airstrikes on Yemen. This, according to an Israeli media commentator, demonstrates the failure of Trump's threat against Yemen. Moving on to the crisis of Shin Bet Chief's dismissal, which received widespread attention in Hebrew media. Former military intelligence chief Amos Yadlin believes that Israel is heading towards division. Well, do you foresee Israel heading towards decision and a civil war, as been highlighted in this report?
I don't think that it will reach the degree of civil war, but it's a profound difference between the Prime Minister Netanyahu and the Shin Bet or the Shabak leader. The Shabak leader is the internal security forces leader.
But he anticipated that they might have the same destiny as the destiny of what's happening now in Turkey amid huge demonstrations.
I don't think so, because okay. the extremists are a majority and they occupy a big place in the government and in the Knesset as well. And that will escalate the internal conflicts between Israel. You know that during the demonstrations against the amendments of the Constitution, in order to get rid of the Constitutional Court, before the war, we were about to see there's a division of Israel between two parts. Then. But now the situation is different. There is a mix of political differences and personal differences. Netanyahu is defending his interests more than defending the interests of a party.
And that's a position that many politicians dislike.
Yes.
And that's what will cause an escalation. But not to an extent to reach a civil war?
No, civil war, no, I don't think so.
But where would that reach? Because the voices that we're hearing, there are a lot of voices, Israeli voices, that do not want do not accept the way that Benjamin Netanyahu is functioning or is ruling today.
I think it will paralyze the circle of decision in Israel. Up till now, there is a government, there is a prime minister, there are cohesive authority, but when it reaches for escalation between Netanyahu and other responsibles with the Shin Bet, next time will be with the Amman, the military intelligence, and that will be with the Mossad or with the police or something. So then it will turn to be an issue that will paralyze the decision. But anyway, the chief of staff of the army tackles the situation, the defensive situation of the country, but the internal situation, the domestic
issues,
the disputes cannot be solved by the army. It is a political and ideological issues that is different. Now, if the conflict between Netanyahu and
yes.
Shin Bet expands to an ideological thing, because he is the Likud is a rightist, and maybe the other guy is a leftist or something like this, that will expand to ideological, it would be a great danger, it constitutes a danger.
Yes, and here, do you think that Benjamin Netanyahu is willing or is capable of actually controlling or minimizing from any kind such an activity that will lead and would pile up to a civil war? Would they be able to accommodate such a dispute within the, not only within the government, also domestically?
Look, the
because as you're highlighting, self-centered.
The civil war is difficult to imagine in Israel. The civil war means there are two parties.
Division.
Both are groups.
Division.
And they fight each other. I think it's instead, it's not a civil war. Instead, there is differences, and there will be a mess in Israel more than a civil war. Mess that causes people to migrate, to leave Israel. Most of people
yes.
that they have no interest in order to stay or to live in this atmosphere of chaos and between political parties and between security leaders. So
Furthermore, because they furthermore, believe that a change cannot
the
happen.
The capital, the money will not be invested in Israel in this atmosphere.
Okay. Now turning to Syria, where Hebrew media remains focused on the new government's approach. This led a former Mossad official to call on Netanyahu's cabinet to coordinate with the new Syrian administration against Iran and Hezbollah. Do you think Israel may shift towards a more positive stance via the new rulers in Damascus, as it's been highlighted?
Sure, Israel welcomed the topple of Bashar al-Assad and the changed regime, but it expressed its